Ireland.
Hi, Jess.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Pretty good.
So what are you going to talk about today?
All right. So for the last episodes, we promised that we will be doing some distributed system episode.
Fancy.
Yes. So I guess today is the day. Let's talk distributed systems.
Right. So today we're going to talk about more of like an intro to the buzzwords of distributed systems, I think. And that there's distributed system, there's a lot in this topic. And we plan on visiting, like doing a few extra episodes to cover those. But this one is more of a blank slate, talk about the core tenets, core concepts of distributed systems.
Yeah.
Sound fun?
Sounds awesome.
So, JS.
Yes, Lance.
What does a distribution of systems mean to you?
A distribution of systems. All right. So for me, it sounds like multiple systems working together to achieve something.
Aha. So systems, multiple separate systems, right?
Yeah, sure.
And they need to somehow coordinate and communicate, right?
If the goal of the job needs coordination, yes.
Well, although if they didn't, then it would just be individual systems, right? At some point, they need some level of interaction.
I was thinking about like streetlights. Like they don't need to be synchronized to do like a global job.
Huh. I wonder if you would qualify that as a distributed system. I would say they probably is not, right?
Yeah.
It's a bunch of small discrete systems, but they're not coordinating, right?
That would be my guess too.
Yeah. So I guess you could summarize it as like how systems of separate autonomous computing nodes interact.
Okay, I'm good with this description.
So can you think of a few examples of these?
Okay, so telecommunication. So when, let's say, in the old days, when I called someone on a line, the call needed to be switched like between your city, your country, or continent to talk to someone else. So this needs synchronization between all the switching systems.
That's very true. You could say that the internet is also a giant distributed system too.
Oh, that's
and that's something that you interact with daily. Like when you go to google.com or wherever.com, you make an HTTP request from your computer, a client, to a separate server, right? And those are coordinating together. Even like individual processes, you could argue that individual processes within your computer can be treated as a distributed system in that it's like a parallel execution. They don't have context in what each of they're doing. Even though it's still in the same board, it's still a system of individual computing nodes which interact.
Interesting. So you would call all the things that run on the OS a distributed system?
Some might argue that. Yeah, I could totally see that actually.
Huh.
And that's why like there are a lot of parallels between parallelization in a single computer, like multi-threading, different processes, different cores,
right,
and distributed systems. In a sense, they can be used in similar ways in some instances, right?
Right. So all computers like without threading with a single core wouldn't be a distributed system.
Yeah, I guess it would not.
Like
although,
be a sequential.
Although I guess you could treat like the firmware on your hard drive as being a separate system, right?
Right, and like your VGA adapter and whatever.
Exactly, right. So it doesn't need to be as fancy as it seems, right? Distributed systems are sort of everywhere around us, right?
Interesting.
Hmm. So yeah, every one of these individual nodes in a system, they're called nodes, just like in graph theory. And you have edges, which is the communications which they act over, right? So you can view this as a big giant network, a big giant graph, model it at least, right?
Right, right.
It's pretty interesting. I guess you could apply like graph theory to your computer component parts, right?
Yeah, but I feel like when we talk about distributed systems, we mean more about like distributed database or things like that.
Yeah, usually it's things like, at the very least, over the network,
yeah,
different computers over the network coordinating to achieve a single goal, I guess. Why is distributed systems hard?
Right. First, is it hard?
I would posit that it is difficult. It makes your life hard if you want to venture into the land of distributed systems. Difficult to understand, and also, I would say, in practice, it's much harder.
Yeah, okay, so to answer your question, I would say it's pretty much the same limitation than parallelization, as in you never know like the order of the actions. So you, let's say you send a message, you don't know, oh, let's say you send two messages, you don't know necessarily in which order they will arrive on the other side.
Yeah, very, very true. And the reason for that is usually because like the channel through which these messages are being passed over is like can be slow, unreliable, could be lots of different paths from one computer to the next. One computer could like receive the first message second and the second message first, and so from its perspective it seems as though your second message was the first message, stuff like that, right?
You said an interesting word here, reliable.
Yeah,
so like when we do a distributed system over a network, we can't rely on the reliability of the network.
Exactly. And I would say, in although it's, I guess, the case in individual computers too, I guess you can't rely on like your PCI Express lane on being there. But in practice, you can, right?
Yeah, because so if your PCI lane is not there anymore, you have other issues.
Yeah, exactly. But so that's what I mean in that it's like computer science, but harder in a sense in that you have like more limitations. And one of the first things you learn is that like different computers have different clock speeds, right? So they execute instructions at different intervals, at different times, right?
So you need to synchronize.
Exactly. So something as primitive as like your CPU clock speed and relying on that to perform instructions is not a given in distributed systems.
Interesting.
So usually it's hard, right?
Okay. Let's agree on the hard.
So one example of a real-world application which attempts to like solve this distributed systems issues is TCP, right? So if you make a bunch of requests, like if you make a request, you have to send a bunch of packets from your computer to the other, but as we said, it could be unreliable, you can lose some, they could arrive out of order, and the entire TCP protocol, its purpose in life is for you to achieve, like, I guess, reliable, consistent message passing over networks.
Or I guess more reliable.
Yeah.
Because like, let's say if you cut the network cable.
Yeah, of course.
You won't save it.
Yeah, exactly. TCP is like notoriously slow to start, and everyone talks about it taking too much time for network requests. So, I mean, it's doing a lot of work there just to coordinate these two computers. So, JS, when I say that a distributed system might be transparent, what do you think that means?
Transparent. Interesting. I would say that you can communicate with anyone and you don't necessarily need to know what they're running.
Aha! That's right, actually. In a sense, it's that like most distributed systems tend to want to abstract away all of the details of their system. And that like when you, again, go to google.com or your favorite search engine.com, you just post to a single domain, right? And it returns an entire response back to you.
And you don't care if underneath it, it's Linux or Windows or BSD or whatever.
Or how many servers they're running or whether their database is sharded or where the response came from or where things were routed to, right?
Okay. So you have like a protocol here like HTTP and that's it. You don't know anything else.
Yeah.
Or you don't need to know anything else.
Yes, you don't need to know anything else. And so what's sort of cool about this concept is that this is kind of one of the benefits, I would say, of going for a distributed system. I guess we can talk about it more a bit later, because I know we're planning on talking a bit more later about this. But in opting for a distributed system, you don't necessarily reach like the physical limits of an individual computer, in that you can, it could seem as though it's coming from an individual computer, but could be serving millions of people concurrently with tons of different databases, and you're able to serve that need, I guess, right?
So, for example, if I go on google.com and you go on google.com, we shouldn't see any difference. But maybe you're served from a server from Montreal and I'm served from a server in BC or whatever.
Yeah. You could tell from that comment that we're both Canadian. that's funny. So exactly. The thing is that whoever is serving that can, in a sense, distribute their system how they like it, with the appearance of it being an individual computer. Like, it could be running off someone's local host, but you just don't know.
Running Google on a single machine.
Yeah. So that brings us into this buzzword. Is it scalable?
Is it web scale?
Is it web scale? Right, yeah. So what is being web scale? What is scalability?
So for me, being web scale is piping data into DevNull. Like, you can't go faster than that.
That's true, you can't go faster, especially if you have 1,000 computers doing that.
No, honestly, I think it's just an expression meaning, can you scale on, like, the internet scale?
So, but you use the word scale
a lot.
As part of the definition of scalability. Can
okay.
you please redefine scalability, Jess?
Let's say you become a big company on the internet. Are you able to serve all the requests?
Uh-huh, yeah. So a scalable system is one that should be independent of the amount of users and resources it needs to accomplish the same goal.
From the outside, not necessarily from your builds.
Yeah, exactly. So as it expands, it should be transparent to your users. Transparency, right?
Yeah.
That
you have more servers.
Exactly, yeah. They shouldn't need to care. And you could do that in a sense. It doesn't require, I would say, not more work. It could perform. It has the capability of performing as well with 1 million users as it does with 1,000.
So this is a definition of web scales with air quotes, right?
Yeah. But so even then, like, it's a super buzzwordy word, and that it's not a very rigid definition. People think that, I guess scaling, I mean, I guess it makes sense in that, like, algorithms scale because they could have, like, sublinear, you know, but...
Right, but in real life, you always hit new crazy things when you scale really big.
Yeah, so there are definitely side effects, right? You also hear the terms scaling up and scaling out,
right.
Also part of the same buzzword dictionary. What do those mean to you?
Okay, so could I say vertical scaling and horizontal?
Yeah, people say that too.
Okay, cool. How I see it is that vertical scaling is buy a bigger computer to serve the same thing. So here, aka buy a better mainframe. And horizontal scaling means I can put more computers in my distributed system and it should be able to perform more work.
Right. So yeah, when you scale vertically, it's like you take your nodes in your system as is and just make every individual one of those nodes faster or more powerful, right? In practice, that's very difficult to do, right? In that you usually reach a physical limit.
Right. I would say at the beginning, it's the easiest one because
yes.
you just put more money at the task.
Yeah. Whereas scaling horizontally, usually your software's architecture needs to be amenable to adding more nodes to get more performance, right?
Because, for example, most of the time you have a single point of failure, let's say your database. So now how do you horizontally scale your database? Because at some point you'll reach the maximum size of one machine can be for your database.
Yeah, and so the solution to that is to, like, shard your database. But you can't just, like, wake up one morning and be like, let's shard this database, right? Which is, like, sharding is, like, splitting tables and, like, split a big table into two separate tables on two different DBs and knowing how to reach, like, routing to the right ones, right?
Yeah. Normally, it could be, like, by the index.
Yeah.
So all, let's say, even index are
yeah.
on one machine and all the odds are on the other machine.
Yeah, or it could be range-based, too, right? Regardless, when you scale horizontally, you usually need to accommodate for that in your software, right? In the sharding case, you need to know how to route to that thing. Like, your software needs to know that. You can't just, like, buy beefier machines.
Yeah. So it's more complex.
It is more complex. Other than the cost of running more nodes, you should have less scale. Like, it should actually scale, right? And that, like, you can always add more.
Yeah, because you won't reach the maximum size of the computer.
Exactly.
If you have an issue, just buy a new rack and plug your new server.
Right.
And here, everything is really theoretical, because even if you're really good at horizontally scaling, you already always reach some limit of something.
Yeah. It's funny because even in the database, like the database example, right? At some point, like your load balancer or whatever it is that needs to decide how to route your request to the right table, at some point that will get bottlenecked, right?
Yeah.
And so like you now need to like scale your scaling solution, right? It's like
you need to load balance your load balancer.
Yeah. Reminds me of like Pin My Ride exhibit. I heard you like load balancers.
Here's something that we don't necessarily talk about is the dimensions of scaling.
Right.
For now, we only talked about the size. So I have more traffic, I need more power to execute all of those. But we also have geography. So let's say my data server is in New York, but I have customers in India. The speed for them will be way worse because they need to do like the planet round trip to get a result. So we would need to scale horizontally to India, let's say, to give them better performance. So I have the data server in India that is synced with the New York one.
That's something you can't scale vertically, right? You can't have like a computer wrap around the planet, right? And unfortunately, we're limited by the speed of light. And so there is actually, again, like a physical limitation to...
Do you know how long it takes to do the, like, walk the whole planet at the speed of light?
I've never tried it. I've never done that, so no, I don't. I can't speak from experience.
All right, I'm curious now.
And so another point to add on there is that people talk about scalability in that they can achieve the same performance with more machines, more users, just by scaling vertically or horizontally, right? It should also be with fewer resources, ideally, right?
What do you mean?
In that, if you added one node to your system by scaling out, you should theoretically be able to add 10 nodes for the same like developer cost, right?
If your solution easily scales horizontally.
Right, but if it does, then it would be scalable.
Right.
So I think that's also a part too, is that like theoretically you should be able to scale out horizontally as much as you want for the same initial cost of scaling, right?
All right, so every time you add a new node, it should be the same price then for your first new node.
Right, yeah. Ideally there shouldn't be. I think in principle it's hard in that just arriving to a solution which will let you do that means a lot of upfront investment.
Right.
But yeah, that's another like facet of it, I guess.
Yeah, because like in the vertical world, it's really expensive because let's say you need to buy a new mainframe. So you need to actually go buy it and install it and move all your old thing to the new mainframe. So there's a lot of, it's a big price.
Not with the cloud
anymore. Right. So do you want to talk about the cloud?
Sure. Why doesn't everyone just scale? You know, why don't they just like do it? Why is this a hard thing to do? Like,
well,
what limits do you like hit in doing this?
I would say first, most people don't need to scale.
That's a very good point. That's a very good point.
So here it's not a technical issue.
Yeah.
It's that you don't have enough customers.
Yeah, premature optimization.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cryptization is the root of all evil.
Isn't that Newth? Yeah, I think
it
is. Yeah. Yeah, so don't do that. But it's the trend now. I think we'll probably talk about it in a future episode with like the whole microservices movement and how it's the hot new thing, right? To like start with a Kubernetes cluster as the first thing you do in your new startup.
Yeah.
Which is probably an inversion of the true priorities at that stage.
But do you realize like Kube came out of beta last year? Like,
right.
It's new.
I mean, it's been around for...
Still, but...
What, 5 years now?
Something like that, but
yeah.
Still.
Yeah, 5 years in computer time is ages, though. But yeah. So usually a lot of the limits, like why people don't... I guess by going to opt for something like Kubernetes as the first thing you do in your new startup, people try to prematurely optimize this and say that, like, I don't want to run into these problems down the road, right?
But it's so much more complex.
Oh, yeah. It is much, it adds a lot of overhead.
And I would say most people won't never reach
yeah.
the size where they would actually need Kubernetes. So,
okay, so how about this as a question? When do you need Kubernetes? In what situations?
When you're not able to manage your servers without it.
What makes you unable to manage your servers?
Okay, so at some point you'll have too many servers, so just using manual deploy. Okay, so you start by having one server. You manually configure it. Afterward, you have three servers. You can still manually configure them. But when you reach, let's say, 10 servers, it starts to be an issue.
Yeah.
So now you start to use like Chef, I think, or Terraform, like tools to like do automatic...
Yeah, like configuration management tools.
Yeah. So at that scale, it's the right tool. You don't need all the fancy, cool things.
Yeah. But I guess what you're coming up with, like the problem there, what makes it difficult is that like you as the programmer are a centralized resource for how all of these things should be laid out, right?
And not sure I follow you.
And that, like, it's hard to, like, usually you reach limits in that, like, either you as a person or the computer has, like, needs to know too much information to
right.
be able to effectively scale out, basically, right?
Yeah, if we go back, like, to Google, at some point, they're, like, if you index the whole internet, at some point, you have too much data to be able to do the search on a single hard drive.
Exactly. So that's when you must partition it out, right? You need, like, you've reached that limit. Similarly, like, if you have too much data and you want to serve the entire world requests that need this data, you can use things like cache or, like, read replicas of your database. And read replicas, you can have infinitely many of them and...
Air quotes.
Yeah, so the problem with that is that, like, now you could have inconsistent state, right? And that you have stale data on your read replicas because people are writing to your write master. That's a separate problem.
So to answer your initial question, when do we need to go to Kube or Sun or any other solutions like that? Do you have an answer?
Probably when you don't have any other choice. Like, when you reach these limits,
okay.
When you say, like, I my business is growing, I need to serve more requests, I need to store more data, but I just cannot anymore. Maybe at that point it's a bit too late, but I think that's a good point, right?
So in summary, don't pre-optimize.
Right. So last term, fancy distributed systems, buzzwordy term that people have is availability or being fault tolerant.
Hmm.
Do you hear that a lot?
Definitely availability. Fault tolerance, I would say, less often,
yeah.
Except on like blog posts of like huge companies.
Yeah.
Like, I remember at some point I read an article, I think from Google, saying like they have so many hard drives that every like minute they lose data and they need to be fault tolerant for that to not impact their customers.
Right, so what is a fault? I guess you kind of answered it there, but like...
When your hardware doesn't do what it should do.
So I would also not just scope it to hardware, right? It could also be software, right?
Like a bug?
Yeah, it could be anything which causes behavior which you do not expect.
Okay,
right?
I can accept that.
And so fault-tolerant systems, what they try to do, they are systems which attempt to handle or manage or keep working when failures happen,
right?
So
like for hard drive, it could be RAID. So you have, let's say, two hard drive having the same-ish data. So if you lose one hard drive, the other hard drive can still answer the query, and you can put a new hard drive to do a new clone.
Right, and so that's a great example of using replication, right? So it's a distributed system in that you're replicating one, and it makes it so that it's more reliable, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's a good example of how like distributed systems can help, right? That's like a benefit of doing this.
I feel like the one we most of the time hear about is network failures.
Yeah. Those are the ones you usually can't control as much, right? And that like you can't predict when they'll happen, I guess.
But they will.
They will happen. And yeah, I guess fault-tolerant systems are ones that at least like continue to work or at least fail gracefully those events.
So if, let's say, your cache is down, you should still be able to answer queries, but maybe slower, more slowly, but still not be down.
Yeah, or either reach into cache, or if like your database is down, keep working with a working cache, but just if you need to write something, just like let them know that it's not working.
So a degraded...
A degraded experience, yeah. So fault-tolerant systems are systems which have 100% availability.
What does it mean?
In that a user can use the system, it behaves as it worked, as it's intended, 100% uptime, nothing ever bad happens.
But this doesn't exist, right?
Never exists.
Okay,
no.
Cool.
Yes, so yeah, fault-tolerant systems are like unheard of. It's more like just like highly available systems.
Right. So in fact, it's you try to achieve that, but you never reach 100%.
Just because you can't predict every possible fault that could exist in your system.
Yeah.
On that note, there's the famous CAP theorem too that people talk about, and that also has to deal with faults. In that, what example do we use here?
But first, we could define what's the CAP theorem.
Oh, right. Yeah, we can absolutely do that.
So CAP, as in C-A-P. So each letter stands for consistency, availability, and partition tolerance. The theorem is saying that you can only get two out of three. So you can get consistency, availability, but you won't get partition tolerance. Or you could take consistency, partition tolerance, and not availability. Or any other mix, right?
Yeah, apparently it's like misunderstood in that like the author one, they originally misstated it in that you can get all three, and the crux of it is that like if you don't have partition tolerance, you must choose between one of the other two. But if everything's working normally, you actually like normally get all three.
Yeah, so this is only in case of like issues.
Right, and so partition tolerance, what that means is that like it works, it keeps working with failures. So like if there's an example, like if your network is down, that's a fault, right? At that point, you need to make the choice of consistency or availability. And so availability, we know what that means already. It's that, you know, like you're able to use it. Everything works as expected.
I like this definition.
Okay.
So here it's written, every request received a non-error response without the guarantee that it contains the most recent write.
Right, yeah.
So this means that if you have a response which is not an error, you'll get some data that was good at some point.
Yes, precisely. Whereas consistency, it's like of the utmost importance to serve the most recent information.
Okay. And that, right. And you would never answer something that's not the most recent information.
Right. So an example, okay, let's go through an example. I find that an example illustrates this nicely because it's a bit hard to wrap your head around. So let's pretend that there's a network of ATMs and there's no centralized system. They all just talk to each other. If you walk up to any one of these ATMs, like you have an account with this bank, and so you would expect that you can walk to any one of them, see your balance, and perform an action like deduct, like withdraw money, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
So in normal cases, when all of the networks are linked and everything's fine, everything's behaving with no faults, you can go up to any ATM, use it in that you don't get an error response, and make sure that if you did it and you went to the next ATM the next second, it would reflect whatever action you did, like a withdrawal.
Right. So you couldn't take the same money twice.
Exactly. Right. So it's both consistent in that you're always seeing the latest thing that happened. It's available in that nothing unexpected happened. You didn't get an error or a denial or something. This was because, I guess, it was tolerant to partitions.
Which... We didn't have any partition in this example.
Yeah, but if you do, let's say one ATM is disconnected from the network, can't find any of its peers can't find it. Now your that ATM machine needs to make the choice between consistency or availability.
So if it chooses consistency, this means that it won't let you do any action.
Right, it wouldn't let you, exactly. You'd walk up to it and it'd be out of service. So that's... Available, No, that's consistent. Yeah.
Because it gives you an error because it doesn't want to.
Yeah, show you, because it doesn't know what the most recent information is, right? Yeah. But it's not available in that, you can't use it as you expect to use it.
Yeah. But if we flip it around, so if we become AP, so available on partition tolerance, this means that this ATM would let you take out your money.
It would let you take out your money, but if you went to the next ATM over, you might see a different balance, right?
So you could take the money twice.
You could, yeah. So that's why, I guess in the ATM example, it probably makes sense for a bank to choose consistency over availability.
Yeah, there's no reason to choose A.
But you as the system designer can choose either. And for different parts of your system, like maybe they want to make your bank balance available, but make your
actions.
Rights, your actions consistent. That's a valid thing to do too, right?
So if that was the choice, this would mean that the... If you go at the ATM that is disconnected, you could see your old balance, but you couldn't take money.
Yeah. So it just explores like the fact that, yeah, these faults will happen in these systems and that you can't control them, but that the outcome is sort of what you're expecting, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So that was the cap theorem. But later on, someone else gave us a new theorem. Okay,
yes.
So what's the name?
The worst acronym.
PACSELC.
It's horrible.
PACSELC? So PACELC. So it's like the extension of CAP. It's saying, so what is it saying? I'll just read it. It's an extension of the CAP theorem. It states that in the case of network partition in a distributed system, one has to choose between availability and consistency. So that's the CAP theorem. But else, even when the system is running normally, in the absence of partition, one has to choose between latency and consistency.
Why do you, can you speculate why that would be?
Yeah, absolutely. So latency means giving an answer quickly, right? Let's say you have a distributed database, which is distributed on like 5 countries. If you want to have a low latency, you can simply answer with the value you have on your replicate. So let's say I ask the Canadian database, what's the value in the account of Lens? I would get instantly the answer. So this is low latency. But if I want consistency, this database would need to contact other database to make sure that everyone agrees on the state of Lens account.
So, and that takes time, right?
Right.
To synchronize with all of these systems.
Exactly.
And so you reduce your latency.
Well, you increase your latency.
Oh, sorry. Yes. Right. You increase your latency by doing all this coordination to ensure consistency. So there is always that trade-off still.
Right. So that was the extension of the CAP theorem.
I guess it's interesting, but I don't know if it merits a whole new acronym. Like, I think it's a good asterisk on the CAP theorem.
I feel like it's useful because like the CAP theorem is only in case of errors, which shouldn't be often, but this trade-off is all the time. So I feel like this is more important because all the time when your things is working correctly, you need to choose between being fast or being consistent.
True. I think it's a more like wholesome
right.
thing. Like it's more wholesome theorem or whatever it is. I guess it's novel in that it introduces the latency thing. I don't know, I guess in approaching the CAP theorem, I kind of like from other distributed systems, knowing that you have to coordinate and that takes time, like it was sort of just like a part of the CAP theorem already,
right.
I found. But
if you choose consistency, you don't have low latency.
Exactly. Yeah. I guess in a sense, it's reducing your availability and that. Availability should be that it behaves without, like, as you expect, and it's taking longer, right?
Yeah,
so.
But I wouldn't say that giving a slow answer is less available, because the availability is more about, I didn't give you an error when I shouldn't.
To a point, though, right? Like, if you have to wait 5 minutes to get a response back.
Well, it depends. What's the action?
If it's retrieving information. You see what I mean? Like,
yeah, but I don't necessarily accept it. I would say it's like it depends on the system and the requirement.
Yeah, I guess. That's just how I like traditionally thought of it. And so this Pakelk thing or Pasilk or whatever it is. I don't know. It just feels like a small asterisk to really like make a more accurate statement
right.
about what it's doing. So that's all we had for today.
Right.
It's quite a long episode, and there's still much to cover.
Yeah.
So I think we'll probably do 2 or 3 more episodes in the future on distributed things.
Yeah.
So there's still interesting things to talk about, like different patterns you can use, and like consensus algorithms are very fun too.
Right.
So I don't know if they'll be next, but at some point in the future, we'll likely discuss those.
Right. We didn't decide what's the next podcast.
Yeah, no. It's a mystery to us all.
Yeah.
All right.
So that's it.
Yeah, that's it. Thanks, Jess. Thanks, listeners.
Thanks,
Matt.
You can contact us and find show notes on our website, randomlytyped.com.
The intro music is by Vansky.
Thank you, Vansky.
And thank you, listener, for indulging us.